Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin with the latest on health and healing and talk about the nutrients that can promote muscle growth as you age, which is very important, and also how resveratrol, that's the nutrient in grapes and blueberries, how it can impact your metabolism and also help your brain do better signaling. That's very important. And how lemongrass has a lot of great health benefits, and I'll go through them. And there's new research that shows that Alzheimer's disease just may be associated with diabetes. And I'm going to give you a whole different way of looking at Alzheimer's today. Also, today is commentary day. We're going to have a commentary from Mike Whitney from Counterpunch, The Double Standards. Where were the liberal protesters during Obama's wars? From Larry Chen, Global Research, the CIA's deep state, and Donald Trump and his war on terrorism. Not a good formula. And what happens when we have nothing left but the Pentagon? William Endall, or William Hartung. And my guest in the second part of our program will be a part of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. He is Professor David Orr. He is the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics at Oberlin College, and he's also the James Marsh Professor at the University of Vermont. We're going to talk about our entrance into the dangerous years of climate change and environmental and social emergencies and what we can do to protect ourselves. We had an enormous feedback of people who were kind of bummed out by the statements of Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson on what he sees as things collapsing in the very near future, starting in as little as 2 years. Well, they've already started to collapse around the world in different places. If you live in Louisiana, your whole home has collapsed because of the flooding this year and other places that it's happened. But with McPherson, he's suggesting it's going to be the end of a lot of what we've taken for granted. So my idea is, what can we do to have a better outcome? So we're going to deal with that. We have a lot to share. Plus, if time permits, and I don't know that it will, I want to get to some of the ways that men and women can join together on a humanitarian basis to apply their energies towards a new national, local, regional, and global effort on women's issues. And I'll go into that in depth if we have time. I also want to share the voices of women who are speaking out around the world against honor violence, which is epidemic. Hundreds of millions of women are impacted by honor violence. And if you're not familiar with it, you will be after our discussion. So let's begin. From Tufts and Georgetown Universities, they've done a study about L-carnitine, and they found that it increases lean muscle mass, which is good, and leg strength, especially in healthier older adults. And this was a placebo-controlled study. Now, I suggest that this was an 8-week study, and I suggest we use carnitine every day of our lives. And we need L-carnitine, we need vitamin D3, we need vitamin C virtually every day. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition and Metabolism. And what they found is as you age, of course, you begin to lose muscle mass. Well, one of the reasons we lose muscle mass is because our hormones change and we start to lose human growth hormone. But if we took the nutrient DHEA, that helps with all of our major hormones being brought back up to normal. If we go on a healthy plant-based diet and exercise every day, that also helps, so that there's no law that says, oh, gee whiz, you're 50, you have to have wrinkles, gray hair, loss of energy, lots of pains. It's just not normal. In fact, virtually all of the conditions we now call normal to aging are not. They are normal for inflammation. So by taking L-carnitine, it helps your heart. It helps provide more oxygen and nutrients to your heart. Hence, your heart has more energy. But now we know that L-carnitine also provides your muscle cells with an increase in protein synthesis. And I suggest that you take 15 to 20 grams of complete vegetable protein spiked with what is a very important combination of amino acids that will help get more protein into the tissue. You take this before you do a workout or within about 15 to 20 minutes after a workout. The branched chain amino acids and also creatine monohydrate, about 2,000 or 3,000 milligrams. And watch how your muscles begin to de-age. So there's no reason that you should have to be losing muscle mass and becoming weak. Also another study, and this one showed that there are indeed superfruits. And one of the superfruits that I pay attention to, because it has a lot of science behind it, would be the pomegranate. Now, the pomegranate is high in water content. And water content from fruits and vegetables like watermelon or grapefruits or grapes, all that water inside the cells, that's known to rebuild cells. And also because the nutrients it has in it, these are very strong anti-aging benefits when you have any watery fruit, like an apple as well. But the research done in Switzerland at the École Polytechnique Institute in Lausanne found that pomegranate contains a powerful molecule. Now, this molecule is called urolithin, U-R-O-L-I-T-H-I-N-A, which assists in regenerating damaged or worn-out cells and makes way for new cells in the process. This is terrific. This would be like having a vacuum cleaner that goes through the arteries and the walls of the arteries and takes out that which is bad, destroyed, damaged, and allows for new rejuvenation. And this magical molecule was produced by the fruit on its own, and it requires assistance from the bacteria found in your gut, and it enables the muscle cells to be protected, and it protects those against aging. Quote, it's the only known molecule that can relaunch the mitochondrial cleanup process. We believe our research uncovering the benefits of the urolithin A holds promise in reversing muscle aging. And that's from the professor, head of the Neurodegenerative Disease Laboratory at the Institute. All you have to do is look at all the other things a pomegranate will do to know why you should be taking it. It has vitamin C and vitamin K, nice fiber and folic acid. But it's extremely beneficial, can lower your cholesterol, and it is known to help, by the way, with mineral rebalancing, including potassium. In just the average pomegranate, you're getting over 660 milligrams of potassium and 100 milligrams of phosphorus, about 107 micrograms of folate. That's good, 11 grams of fiber, so you're getting a lot of benefit. But what else does it do? Now, you can have pomegranates by eating the little pomegranate. That's good. By taking in the pomegranate juice unsweetened, good. The pomegranate concentrate, better. Or the pomegranate the powder made from the drying the concentrate, best of all, because you're getting more of it. As we age, the powerhouses of cells called the mitochondria are unable to carry out their regular functioning at the same level they were when you were younger. So consuming this wonderful fruit assists in protecting cells against damage. It also helps cells to recycle and rebuild themselves. And pomegranate reduces the risk of heart disease and inflammation of the heart and the arteries. and your brain as well. I have seen a lot of people benefit when they've had arthritis by taking pomegranate. I've seen people's memory improved and boosting metabolism so people lose weight, and men in battling prostate cancer. Now, of course, I put those people on very high concentrates of pomegranate, not just taking it occasionally. I'm talking about large amounts. But it does do that. It's very antioxidant-rich, and it can help you lower your blood pressure, and it helps prevent cognitive heart failure. It also helps prevent fat from building up around the arteries, which, if ongoing, can lead to several heart problems if you have fat where it shouldn't be. And it has very wonderful polyphenols that have anti-cancer benefits. And consuming pomegranate juice, what you would do, you would crush the seeds if you were doing it yourself, or you would buy it already in a bottle, is known to improve blood flow and blood pressure. And it delays the oxidation of low-density lipoproteins, the LDL, or bad cholesterol, and especially important if you have heart disease and you take the cholesterol and the LDL, it puts you at risk of a heart attack. By taking pomegranate every day, twice a day, it can help mitigate that. It fights against atherosclerosis. It stops damage brought about by the destruction of free radicals, thus preventing and reversing the natural process of aging. It protects against osteoporosis, and it inhibits platelet aggregation. So if you had a choice of taking an aspirin, which 25 to 30,000 people die each year from bleeding of the ulcers caused by it, but it thins the blood, or taking pomegranate with vitamin C, oh, there's just no question. I'd be taking pomegranate with vitamin C to thin my blood to help prevent a stroke. And pomegranates also support and benefit the functioning of the immune system. So a whole lot of good there that most people are not aware of. But you got to do it, again, it's the consistency, daily basis. There are good study out of the University of Kentucky showing that resveratrol can improve energy metabolism, cell signaling pathways, and neurotransmission. And so if you're on a high sugar diet, most Americans are, then you're going to want to control your metabolism because you're just going to gain weight. And if you gain weight, then you're going to end up sick. That's inevitable. Isn't it amazing? Think of it for a moment. I work with people who are overweight all the time. And more than anything else, they're overweight because they're taking in more calories than what they're burning, and they're not exercising, and it's certainly not what they should. And you hear this complaint all the time. Oh, you know, it's such an effort, it's such an effort. Well, what about the effort of gaining that extra weight? You don't have to do anything. You don't have to exercise. You don't have to count calories. You just keep eating the way you're eating, and you're going to gain weight. So it's so easy to gain weight. And yes, it is a challenge to get it off. But if you start watching what you're eating and you consume more foods that are not concentrated in calories, remember, when they process a food, they're taking out the bran, the water, the quality fibers. All of that helps sweep that out of the system. So what you're left with is something that's very concentrated, very dense in calories. Those are not good for you. So make sure you're getting really quality foods that have high water content, watercress, arugula, spinach, kale, collard greens, all apples, oranges, grapefruit, lemon, lime, cantaloupe, honeydew, grapes, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, zucchini, all have good water content. Potato chip, just the opposite. High calories, no water, and a lot of salt. So anyhow, if you want better metabolism, better brain signaling, I would say take 100 to 200 milligrams a day of resveratrol. And finally, there's a good study showing lemongrass. And most people don't use lemongrass. It's easy to grow. It's a wonderful herb. It's not easy to put in cooking because it doesn't break down. What I do is I make I'll just show you how to do this. If you want something to have that lemongrass quality to it, you can do an infusion, in which case you soak the lemongrass till it's very soft, and then you put it into a food processor, and then then you can use some olive oil, and then you pour that and filter off the fiber, and then you get the taste and the color of the lemongrass, which is green, but you don't get any of the pithy fiber. And then when you're cooking, you can spritz that on to a particular dish. For example, if you're making an antipasto and you have some onion, try this. Lightly grill the onion, never till it's black, and then spritz maybe a teaspoon of lemongrass across it and put a little Himalayan sea salt on it. That's the best tasting antipasto onion you've ever had. Anyway, you can make all kinds of infusions and keep them. But lemongrass itself is extremely beneficial. Why? Originally it was a tropical herb and it was used in Asian cooking, but it was also used in medicinal efforts because there's a lot that it does. It has a citrus smell like lemon. It has these long, thin blades of grass. They're very aromatic, but they're great for detoxification. In fact, I suggest lemongrass, not as a tea, but lemongrass in wheatgrass, doing them both together. In other words, you juice the wheatgrass and the lemongrass at the same time, and then put ginger in that. Phenomenal detoxification, doing 2 ounces of that a day. It's very good for your kidneys, your bladder, and your liver. It's known to lower your cholesterol level, and that's important. It reduces the LDL cholesterol and allows you to raise the good HDL cholesterol. It has wonderful antimicrobial and antifungal properties. So if you've been fighting a yeast infection or a gastrointestinal issue or a bacterial overgrowth, you make sure you're having some lemongrass for ringworm, scabies, urinary tract infections. In fact, you could pour 1 ounce of lemongrass into 16 ounces of cranberry drink and drink that down. That would be good. It's known to help reduce fevers. It soothes the throat. It helps cut down on colds and flus. It's anti-inflammatory. And it's good for insomnia to have some lemongrass tea before you go to bed if you're having trouble sleeping. It calms the central nervous system. It relaxes the muscles. It allows you to have a more peaceful night's sleep. It's very good. I suggest it always for people with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, chronic fatigue. It can help diabetics regulate your blood sugar. And it's also one of the many components to help in fighting cancer. It's been shown to have anti-cancer properties. So that's the latest on health and healing. Always information to empower. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
What good is music? What good is melody if it ain't possessing something sweet? It ain't the music.
I'd like to welcome all of you. From our public health segment, I wanted to share this from Brigham and Women's Hospital. We never count iatrogenic or medically induced death or injury outside of a hospital. Boy, what a mistake that is. Because from Brigham and Women's Hospital, a major article that was published in the British Medical Journal, and I'll quote it so that we make sure we get it right here, because these figures are phenomenal. 10,000 Medicare patients die in 7 days after discharge from the ED, emergency department. Quote, nearly one in five Americans will visit an emergency department each year, meaning that physicians make the decision to admit or discharge a patient from the ED hundreds of thousands of times daily, but little is known about how patients fare after they are sent home from the emergency department. Researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital measured how often generally healthy Medicare enrollees died in the 7 days after being discharged home by tracking over 16 million visits to the United States emergency departments. The findings are published in the current issue of the British Medical Journal. Quote, there's a lot of policy interest in reducing unnecessary admissions from the ED, said a staff physician. We know that hospitals vary a lot in how often they admit patients to the hospital from the ED, but we don't know whether this matters for patient outcomes. Researchers found that each year, about 10,000 generally healthy patients die in the 7 days after discharge, mainly from heart disease and COPD. Those were the most common causes of death. So, if you start adding these additional figures into iatrogenesis, it's major. So maybe they should spend more time and not get the people out so quick, especially those people who have heart conditions, because it's killing them. Now what I want to do is I'm going to play you a little segment here. And this is, I'm going to ask our engineers to bring up this one from the clip number four from yesterday, the Nigel clip, because this is going to lead into a commentary that I'm going to share with you about what I'm seeing, and I'm sure many of you see it, and that is just the hypocrisy of how we align ourselves with one politician or one principle, and then we support that person and attack anyone on the other side, irrespective of whether or not our own party, our own belief systems, our own leaders have been equally guilty of distributing misinformation. You know what I'm going to do? They're going to get the clip up. While they're getting the clip up, I'm going to read from Mike Whitney from Counterpunch. It is an article entitled Double Standards, Where Were the Liberal Protesters During Obama's Wars? The election of Donald Trump has sent millions of people pouring out into the streets to protest a man they think is a racist, misogynist, xenophobic bully who will destroy U.S. democracy in his quest to establish himself as supreme fascist ruler of the country. Maybe they're right. Maybe Trump is a fascist who will destroy America. But where were these people when Obama was bombing wedding parties in Kandahar or training jihadists, militants to fight in Syria, or abetting NATO's destructive onslaught on Libya, or plunging Ukraine into fratricidal warfare, or collecting the phone records of innocent Americans, or deporting 3.3 million undocumented workers, more than all other presidents in all administrations in the entire 20th century, or force-feeding prisoners at Gitmo who had never been found guilty of any crime, or providing bombs and aircraft to Saudi Arabia to continue their genocidal war against Yemen. Where were they? They were asleep, weren't they? Because liberals always sleep when their man is in office, particularly if their man is a smooth-talking cosmopolitan snake charmer like Obama, who crones about personal freedom and democracy while unleashing most unspeakable violence on civilians across the Middle East and Central Asia. The United States has been at war for 8 straight years under Obama, and during that time, there hasn't been one single sizable anti-war march, demonstration, or protest. Nothing. No one seems to care when an articulate, biracial Mandarin kills mostly people of color, but when a brash, outspoken real estate magnate takes over the reins of power, then watch out, because here comes the protesters, all 3 million of them. Can we agree that there is at least the appearance of hypocrisy here? Indeed, analyst John Reynolds summed it up perfectly over the Black Agenda report. Quote, if Hillary had won, the drone strikes would have continued. The wars would have continued. The spying would continue. Whistleblowers would continue being prosecuted and hunted down. And minorities would continue bearing the brunt of these policies, both in the United States and across the world. The difference is that in such a scenario, Democrats, if the last 8 years are any indication, would remain silent, as they did under Obama, offering bare minimum concern and vilifying anyone attacking their beloved president as some sort of hater. Cities across the United States would remain free of protest, and for another 48 years, Democrats would continue doing absolutely nothing to end the same horrifying policies now promoted by Republicans. End quote. That was called Delusions Shattered by John Reynolds, The Black Agenda Report. He's right, isn't he? How many of the protesters who marched, and I support them in their march, would have flown to Washington to express their contempt for would-be President Hillary Clinton? I'm willing to wager zero. And yet it's Hillary who wanted to implement the no-fly zones in Syria that would have put Washington in direct confrontation with Moscow, just like it was Hillary who wanted to teach Putin a thing or two in Ukraine. But is that what the people want? Would people prefer to be led into World War III by a bona fide champion of liberal values that can cede the post to a brassy billionaire who wants to find common ground on fighting ISIS with the Russian counterpart? And there it is. That is the hypocrisy of all of it. Okay, now listen to this as just another example of this hypocrisy, and then I'll give you my commentary afterwards.
Because he is not opening up the door to refugees, we've got large chunks of the media, huge sections of the House of Commons, a million people signing petitions, protesters just down the road from where I am now in Whitehall and elsewhere in this country and in America. You're all hypocrites, every single one of you. Not only did you not attack Obama when he put a complete ban for 6 months on anybody coming into America from Iraq, but how about this? How about the fact that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, and the UAE have not taken one single Syrian refugee? In fact, the Saudis said they didn't want to take refugees from Syria because they worried what it would do to the balance of their society. So can we please start condemning these countries? Oh, and let's move on to something juicier, shall we? Real travel bans based on religious prejudice. Did you know the following countries will not allow any Jewish Israeli passport holders into their country? Algeria, Bangladesh, Brunei, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Lebanon, Libya, Malaysia, Oman, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Syria, the UAE, and the Yemen. So can we please ban everybody from those countries? Any leader from those countries must never come here. I'm waiting for Jeremy Corbyn and Tim Farron and Caroline Lucas to stand up and make big speeches. I'm looking forward to the protests against this vile anti-Jewish prejudice. And am I going to see it? Am I going to hear it? No, because it's not Donald Trump and he's the devil. It is all rank hypocrisy. And I wonder what Nick in West Des Moines, okay, in Iowa, makes of all of this.
So he is correct. Now, let me add my own perspective on this to see if this is reasonable or not. And as I always suggest, if something I suggest to you or say you do not find reasonable, then simply dismiss it. If there is something reasonable, then use it to build on with your own ideas. On the one hand, more money will go from our government for the military-industrial complex than at any time in our history. All told, all in, it's not the $655 billion. When you add in all the other agencies, it's about $1.5 trillion. We currently have, I think it's 14 carriers. Trump wants to do 350 of them. He is willing to sacrifice all of our domestic policies in order to have only one foreign policy objective. Now, this is because he has aligned himself with people who are at the heart of the deep state. I'm sure he is unaware of this. He is not an articulate person. He is not a scholar. He has no patience for studying, and he is completely intemperate. He'll surround himself only with people who he considers loyal and obedient, not people who will tell him the truth. The truth is this. He does business. He has golf courses in Saudi Arabia, the number one country in the entire world for arming, training, and protecting ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, is Saudi Arabia. How do we know that? Well, because WikiLeaks gave us the emails of Podesta and Hillary Clinton that showed it. They talked about it in their own emails. We also know because the National Security State monitors every single bank transaction, every single phone call. We know that they have been buying weapons from us, over $224 billion worth, and we give it to them, and then they, along with Qatar and United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and Jordan, they then make these available to al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations. So if you really want to stop terror, then stop doing any trading, any business with a rogue state, and a rogue state is Saudi Arabia. But there's a second state that's equal. It's actually superior to Saudi Arabia in its size of its army, and that's Turkey. Turkey has a complete corrupt hierarchy, and the head of Turkey, Erdogan, and his son have been for a long time stealing the oil. Thousands and thousands of truckers go into these countries, take their oil out of Syria. It's not their oil. It's not Turkey's oil. It's Syria's oil. Bring it back. The United States has been completely observant at all this and then sells this for about $20 a barrel on the black market and then gives that money to itself and also gives it to al-Qaeda or ISIS. That's why al-Qaeda and ISIS has seemed to have an unlimited amount of cash at its disposal. It's all done in Turkey. So now you have to stop doing business with Turkey. But Turkey's, you know, the biggest of our nations that fight with NATO. So they're a NATO ally. So now we've got NATO fully aware of that the whole idea of fighting terror is a game. So then all of the people who are not willing to take any responsibility for the death and destruction, where are the people coming from? Well, first they were coming from the major destruction of Libya. Now, these were educated people. They had good education, incomes. They had a good standard of living. So they could afford boats or other ways of getting out of North Africa, where Libya is, and getting into Europe, Greece, Italy, Germany. Then you had Syria being bombed. And again, who is behind the bombing in Syria? Who's behind the bombing? NATO was officially the sponsor of it, but you had Saudi Arabia and all these other countries, including England and Italy and France, all participating. So behind all the conflict in the Middle East, you have Syria, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Oman, you have, and Turkey. But all except one of those doesn't want to take any refugees at all. Not one. And we don't insist upon it. And yet Saudi Arabia has room right now for over 3 million in air-conditioned tents with water and sanitation. Not a single one are they taking. Now you think, wouldn't you, that the American media would make that a major story? Why is it our allies who are causing the conflict, causing the destruction of homes, causing the bloodshed, causing people to flee their home, become refugees, but they won't take any responsibility and take them in their country? And no one in the Bush administration, when it was happening then, and the Obama administration, and Hillary Clinton, and now Donald Trump, none of them want to discuss this because it's so obvious. That is the rank hypocrisy. And that's unfortunate. So the next time people are demonstrating, which they should, and I support, at least take the time to do your homework. It doesn't take a lot of effort today because there have been so many good articles written by good people on all the issues that we need to be informed about. Now, I don't know if I'll have time today because I'm going to go to my guest in a moment. Because that's such an important topic, what to do when disaster strikes. But I promise you on my next program, I will take a look, an in-depth look at the CIA, the deep state, and how much control they have over the information that is dispersed through the different media. And because we have documents, and under Freedom of Information Act, because we have the transcripts of the Church Committee, we'll be able to give you not our speculative idea, not a hypothesis, not a guess, actual statistics that over 1,300 people within the media were on the payroll of the CIA. The CIA actually wrote the stories it wanted. So what about someone like a Mike Whitney who wants to show you the hypocrisy? What about Chris Hedges? What about Cornel West? How about all the wonderful minds we have out there who are truly progressive who want to show you the truth? Well, they're not going to be on the side of the CIA. So then the CIA, all it has to do is make one phone call, and they don't get the media. They don't get the platform. They have to find some other means of getting it out. That'll be on Monday's show. Now let's go to my guest who is standing by. I gave you just a bit of his background at the beginning of the show. He is Professor David Orr. He is the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics at Oberlin College and the James Marsh Professor at the University of Vermont. And he's nationally recognized as an environmental activist in a variety of environmental efforts, including education and environmental design. And he is here with us today to talk about our entrance into the dangerous years of climate change. Nice to have you with us today.
Gary, thanks. Nice to be here.
Recently, we had a number of guests on our program, all very qualified in their area, but they all had something in common. They're a relatively small group, probably all told about 14 individuals, who are willing to say that the feedback loops and the tipping points which lead to the feedback loops are not being discussed in a way that allows people to see the true severity of our climate crisis. And by governments not becoming involved, institutes not engaging, and only a smattering of the public doing anything, that we face a tsunami of pain coming at us. And as a result of this, I'd like for you to begin by giving us your input as someone who has studied this and other people's works, of the failure of our governments and our institutions, in particular our private industries and financial firms, virtually all of Wall Street, are acting as if this is not as serious as it's been is, and that global warming can be dealt with at some point in the future. And this is more of a regressive worldview or a mindset that our federal and corporate leaders embrace that has given us the denial and, frankly, many false hopes and wishes that our humanity, ingenuity, and technology will not a problem. It'll save us all. Everything will be all right. And then there is the equally disturbing fact that much of the American population continues to believe, such as Trumpsters, that global warming isn't real. The Sean Hannitys, the Rush Limbaughs, it's all fraud, and it couldn't be right. So could you address these two issues, the denialism that is palpable, or the inconvenient truth that even if it were true in the minds of many people, they do not choose to be discomforted by changing anything in their lifestyle to address it? The form is yours.
Well, Gary, thanks for that. The science is really very clear, and it has become more and more clear with almost every passing month. And the fact of the matter is, you put heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, you'll trap heat, and you put a lot there, you'll trap a great deal of heat. And for anybody who needs a metaphor or more direct kind of explanation, it's like being in a parking lot, let's say, in Houston, Texas, on a July day in a car, and you roll up the windows. And what the car does is to trap incoming high-energy radiation and block outgoing low radiation or low-energy radiation. And so the temperature of the car goes from maybe the ambient temperature outside is 90 degrees, and it goes up to 160. And so that's what we're doing to the planet. We simply rolling up the windows, and we busted the air conditioning system, which is the polar ice caps and glacier fields and so forth. And so to answer your question very directly, we are now at about 404, give or take, parts per million carbon dioxide. That's rolling up the windows. That's the heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. And they're accumulating now at the rate of about, give or take, 2.5 parts per million per year. The numbers sound small, and there isn't a whole lot you have to know about the world now, but there are a few things you just have to get right, and this is one of them. This one will kill you. And so what the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has done already is to condemn us to many, many years, centuries to thousands of years of unstable climate. So when scientists in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which has issued 5 reports now, when they said that if we were to stop burning fossil fuels right now for cars and heating and electricity and so forth, we'd have at least 1,000 years of rising sea levels and rising temperatures. And so the fact, the hard fact is that when carbon, once carbon is up in the atmosphere again from combustion of oil and coal and natural gas, once it's up there, it stays there for a long time. And the myth is that, well, with a few technological breakthroughs, we can fix this. And the fact is, it isn't solvable by any known means right now at a price we could afford that could be deployed at a time that really impacts the problem. And this is the dark, dirty secret that's just not being let out. So I don't really worry about the climate deniers. They're going to be kind of like the Flat Earth Society, which in London still has an office, and they keep the light on for you, and you know, pretty soon they're just dismissed as a fringe group. But the reality is more and more people will realize that climate change is happening because sea levels are rising, storms are getting bigger, droughts are longer, temperatures are rising. We've just come through a winter in Ohio, virtually no snow, and the temperature is averaging 6 or 7 degrees higher in Fahrenheit degrees than the average. But the people I worry about are people who do know the science and continue to tell the public that this is, as you were saying, that this is simply solvable by some better technology, and it can all be pain-free, and you can have your lifestyle. We just have to be a little bit smarter about it.
David, I appreciate...
I
appreciate your overview. I want to take it a little deeper now, because for the last 8 years, I have been working on a major documentary concerning the tipping points, and it went from 7 tipping points to 14 tipping points to 21, 33. It's over 40 now. And then the feedback loops. What was hypothetical 8 years ago is reality today. And when I'm talking with people, including the person who was portrayed by Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park as that chaos theorist, that's actually a real person at the University of California. And I asked him, I said, is there any accurate mathematical model that can predict when the bad things are going to happen? He said, no. He said, we can't do that because so many feedback loops are impacting other loops. And when I would ask people, give us an idea when you think that we should become concerned. Some people say, oh, 100 years from now. Well, okay, and then other people say, the moment the Arctic ice is gone, and it could be this summer or next summer, when that Arctic ice is gone, you are now in a countdown to the massive amounts of methane being released, not only from there, but also it's being released now across the tundras and the boreal forests and in Siberia. And we haven't been calculating correctly a lot of these happenings. We didn't calculate the heating from Antarctica from underneath in the last 2 years. Now we know that that's happening. So then I look right in the United States. Right now, as we speak, of all the parishes in Louisiana, not one was spared from just a couple months ago. If you remember, they had the worst flood, a 500-year flood, and 87,000 homes were adversely affected or destroyed in just one parish, and they had no flood insurance because it had never flooded there before in that area. Only a coastline had flooded. Well, those people are still victims. They still don't have a home they can go into. They didn't have insurance. The mold's all everywhere. They're not allowed to go back in unless they tear it down and start from scratch. But we act like that doesn't exist. We act like Fukushima doesn't exist. And yet it's spilling 100,000 gallons of radiation in the water every day in the Pacific, as if that water and the radiation in the Pacific is not adversely affecting, and the coral reefs are bleaching out, as if that doesn't matter. So if you look at each and every one of these catastrophes by itself, in and of itself, it may seem like we've got a long time. But when you pull back and you look at all the pieces of the puzzle and all the feedback loops and see what has been happening with 12,000 extensive weather patterns last year, 36,000 fires last year, just in the United States, 123,000 extreme weather events worldwide, And even a friend of mine in Wyoming just called me 2 days ago saying that his car was totaled in his driveway when hail that had never been seen in Wyoming before, hail the size of grapefruit, hit his car and destroyed it. And the insurance company says, we'll give you a $6,000 check for your car, but it's destroyed. Hail. And yet not a word about that in the media. So then when you look at all this, when do you see that we should become really concerned and start being proactive and making changes in our own lives to protect ourselves, even if society, the institutions, the government are still in the it isn't going to happen in your lifetime scenario?
Well, the only plausible answer is about 50 or 100 years ago. We're already too late. We've already condemned ourselves to a series of cascading disasters. What we hope is that it doesn't accumulate into the catastrophe that destroys civilization itself. But in terms of temperature, Gary, we're at give or take 1.1 degrees centigrade right now warming. The guardrail that scientists have now accepted at the COP21 event was 1.5 degrees centigrade warming. It's not likely we will contain things before we've already transgressed that number. We'd be lucky, frankly, I think, to stop it at 2.0 degrees centigrade warming. But your point is so important, and I couldn't agree more. There are so many feedback. We're destabilizing an extremely complicated system of life and life forms and geology and ecological patterns and climate systems that evolved over 3.8 billion years. And we don't know. We've not inventoried all the life forms on the planet. We really don't know what's hitched to what. And so we're going to discover a lot of things that, oh, my goodness, pollination doesn't occur because temperatures were too high too soon and birds begin to, we're going to see the ripple effects of things that we have undone. And we can't really know what we're doing because we don't know what we're undoing, as somebody put it years ago. It's just too complicated a system, and the smartest thing possible would be to cut carbon emissions as rapidly as possible. But I want to make one other point. The first warning to a U.S. president was given in 1965 to Lyndon Johnson. So the very highest levels of government, we've known since 1965 that climate change could become a global destroying catastrophe. That's been clear. And what's happened ever since is the science has gotten more and more fine-grained. The pixels add up to the picture that is very clear, definitive. There's no serious scientific argument against what you just said and what I'm saying now. But we've had years and years of denial. And Donald Trump is, in this sense, no accident. Donald Trump is the logical working out of a system of politics built around denial and built around anger and hatred, misogyny, and so forth. It began in 1968 officially with Richard Nixon's Southern Strategy. That was built on racism. And so from that time, maybe before, but certainly from that time to the present, and Donald Trump is simply the upshot of the way the Republican Party has chosen. This is not an argument for Democrats, but the way the Republican Party has chosen to win elections. And so denial is built into the way this system works. And Trump is, again, he's not an aberration. He's simply the logical upshot of the way American politics has developed. And then the other side of denial, again, as you point out, is belief that somehow there'll be some technological miracle, whether it's advanced nuclear power systems or whatever, that's going to save us. But there is no technology that doesn't have other side effects, many of which are unforeseen. And there's no technology or technological intervention that can resolve the problem you stated so well, and that is this complicated system of feedback, which we do not understand and probably never could understand. But now we're destabilizing a system that on which we are totally dependent and about which we know relatively little. And so that is portending an incredible disaster. The issue for me is how do we get this on the political agenda in a way that recognizes the severity and depth of the crisis. Again, as I said before, and then you said, is that this is not quickly fixable. This is not solvable in any way that we normally use that word, solvability. What we can do is begin to reduce the carbon flowing into the atmosphere and other heat-trapping gases. and begin to create a very different kind of civilization. I don't think, for me personally, this is going to be one built around capitalism as it is presently conceived. I don't think that the feedback loops there are too many also. So this is a global emergency. And I think Al Gore, a decade ago or so, was right about that.
David, let me share a few ideas that seem disparate but are actually interconnected. This is just in the last few weeks. I spoke with a couple who moved up to Northern California, and because they thought it would be a rather idyllic place, and for about 20 years it was. Now I'm getting the word that the entire forest area is being completely killed by a special beetle, and they tried spraying it. The spraying's not killing it, but the spray is a very toxic spray. And the reason is there's so little rainfall, and it's so dry, and the temperature is so high. Normally, the further up New York State you go, further up any state you go than in the Northern Hemisphere, the cooler it becomes. Now they're saying that there's more fires up there, that they never had a fire before. So many people are moving out. Again, no one's writing about this. Then upstate New York. Now, you'd always think of New York as a very wet state and large water water aquifers. In fact, the Walk Hill water aquifer, it supplies New York City. And I used to have a farm up there. Well, now half of the counties upstate New York are in severe drought. They do not have adequate water, and their aquifers are gone. And hence, you are more susceptible then to not being able to grow things on that land. I got a call from people I know in Colorado who's saying that the forest at the higher altitudes are drying out and beetles are killing them. 100 million trees have been killed in California alone by the beetles. I went up to Arizona and just spoke with someone yesterday about this. At the higher altitude in Flagstaff, there's dryness, high heat, and fires. And where it used to be, you wouldn't have any fires, and it'd be cool. So when I'm looking around the United States, I'm seeing at least 20 states that, in my opinion, studying it carefully, will not be sustainable in the future. They're simply running out of water. And these, including much of Florida and Georgia and Alabama, including Kansas and Colorado and South Dakota. And, of course, we already realize that Nevada and New Mexico and Arizona and 90% of Texas and 80% of California are running out of water and are going to be in severe drought, irrespective of what an El Nino may bring some, for a period of time, may fill some of the aquifers and reservoirs, but that's going to go down. And yet, what we're not having is a national dialogue. And I believe exactly what you just said. We must enlist the environmental people, the men and women of America, to take up the challenge of starting first to educate themselves by reading the good articles. And I believe that we should post at least 100 to 200 quality articles by yourself and the other people who have something to say that's honest, so that they can look at all the different things, from the oceans to the plastic in the oceans to the heat of the temperature of the oceans to the increasing hurricane velocities. Everything about our environment that's honest and legitimate should be posted. Then there are documentaries that could be post up there. There's at least 55 documentaries I'm aware of that are honest, that we could then educate ourselves. And then start at the local level, because we have a lot of power at the local level. What can we do, enlisting local school boards, local city councils, to act on some aspect of this, to try to bring back organic farming, to lower the carbon footprint, to stop buying things in plastic, to start looking to see how much water we have, to stop hydrofracking that uses a lot of water and pollutes the water it doesn't use, to stop the gas, to turn off nuclear, to start the renewables, to getting solar, and even to lobby at the national level for National Transportation Administration to get us high rail, high speed, non-polluting. They now have in Italy, they have a non-polluting high speed train, and in France as well. But Japan and China and Germany are already way ahead of this, so that we don't have to fly from city to city or drive from city to city. We could take this non-polluting form of transportation. I'd rather see $1 trillion put into that than $1 trillion put into another war in the Middle East. So I believe we must act. I believe we must start to actualize, and we can't actualize without information, and information from quality people who are not afraid to tell the truth, and then educate them, and then start organizing at the local, the state, and the national level. Your thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, the book I just published from Yale University Press called Dangerous Years concludes with what we're doing in the little town of Overland, Ohio. Overland is 35 miles west of Cleveland. We're dead center, Rust Belt. Detroit's 84 miles off to one side. Youngstown's an hour or so to the east. But we're Rust Belt. And in that little community, the energy around solar is terrific. We started a solar co-op. Last year we had 37 houses. Solarize, we'll do another 37. This is in a little town of about 9,000 people. We just finished a hotel conference center last year that's powered entirely from a portion of the electricity delivered off from an off-site photovoltaic array that's about a half a mile distant. And so even in Ohio, a place where sunshine is kind of a theory, you can power buildings by sunshine. The Adam Joseph Lewis Center that we built a decade before is entirely powered by two photovoltaic arrays on site and generates a surplus of about 40% per year. Organic agriculture is booming in lots of places, not because anybody told them you had to do it, but because the food is fresher, tastes better, and it's local farmers, and you get to know the local farmers. So we have a goal within our community of a 70% food self-reliance. This is happening all over the world, but the interesting thing is this doesn't make the headlines. But people in Europe and China and South Asia and all across the United States and the transition town movement in Britain, these are people beginning to take control of their food and their energy and their housing and economic situation. And I can tell you from what's happening in Oberlin, we're calling this the Oberlin Project, that it has boomed for the past 8 years, and lots of things have occurred in our little town, which again is Rust Belt. But it's attracting lots of attention. It's attracting lots of investment and people, and across the political spectrum. At our meetings to form the first solar co-op, there were professors wearing bulletproof glasses and guys coming in camouflage. Then there were Trump voters and Hillary Clinton voters, Bernie Sanders supporters. And so there was across the spectrum. These are the things that can unify people. And we don't, if somebody doesn't believe in climate change, you know, fine, I don't want to argue with them. You know, nobody much argues about the laws of gravity, and if they do, they're very simple tests. You know, come to the top of the building and, you know, you jump first and see how it works out for you. With climate change, it's just simply physics and chemistry. This is a remorseless forking of these big numbers. But if somebody chooses not to believe it, fine, but would you like to be independent of your local power utility? And the answer comes back, yes. So, you know, would you like to have better food at lower cost and serve from farms in the local area? And the answer is coming back yes. So there are certain trends that are starting at the grassroots level all across the United States. And I think that's what we have to build on. And then hopefully sooner or later it cascades upward into a major political revolution.
Well, David, we're out of time. We're out of time. And the book is, by the way, Dangerous Years, Climate Change, the Long Emergency, and the Way Forward by Yale University Press. And the website is Oberlin, O-B-E-R-L-I-N, project.org. As of this week, I will hire someone on staff that will accumulate every documentary, every call to action, every project like the Oberlin Project, every article, every talk that enlightens, informs, and educates us so that we have our education in place. We have our knowledge in place. We can deal with these issues, and then we go forward from there. So I thank you very much for all the great work that you're doing, David, and I look forward to another conversation.
Well, Gary, thank you, and I do as well.
David Orr. He's Professor Paul Sears, Distinguished Professor of Environmental Science Studies and Politics at Oberlin College, and James Marsh, Professor at University of Vermont. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.